It is Saturday, November 2nd, 2013. We are broadcasting live from Santa Cruz on the central coast of California. This is KUSP Public Radio 88.9 and KUSP.org. It's time now for Geek Speak. We're through being cool. We're through being cool. Eliminate the ninnies and the twits. Hey, welcome to Geek Speak, bridging the gaps between geeks and the rest of humanity. Please keep in mind that the views expressed during Geek Speak are not necessarily those of KUSP. I'm Bonnie Jean Primch, mediator and broadcaster, hosting. Normally, Lyle Troxel does that, but he's here too. Lyle Troxel.
Surprise! I'm in the room.
Programmer, photographer, father, radio host.
And all that jazz.
All that jazz. Taking a little bit of it. We're each giving each other a little bit of a break.
I think that's been about 6 years since I've been in the air room when somebody else started the show. Yeah. Sorry. See, I'm already talking over you.
That's fine. You guys don't care, right? You can handle it.
I think we're good.
Anyway, so yeah, it's Lyle and Bonnie here bringing you geek news today. That's the primary function of the show, is just letting you know what's going on and then what it means for you.
In fact, everyone's taking a break, even Rick. He's not here. So
even
we have
Rick's
no phone
here.
Calls.
That's
just
right.
Just us, baby.
Yeah.
And I got news.
You got news.
I do.
Hey, you know, I'm so glad that you guys covered that mysterious block in the shipping yard in San Francisco.
Oh, yes, this giant structure.
It's creepy, and there's one in Maine, too, now.
And you've seen the pictures. It looks a little bit like a Borg cube, right?
Yeah, yeah. It's super creepy.
I mean, it really did when they had the netting over it, and then when it ticked down, it's kind of white and shiny, so it's a little different.
Oh, so it's white and shiny.
Yeah, and it's actually been moved since last time we talked about it, and a little bit more stories come out. This is clearly something Google's building. It's very large.
Yeah.
It's on a barge.
Okay.
And it's made from shipping containers that have been opened up on the sides and kind of put together in kind of a Lincoln log, or I guess a Lego kind of fashion.
Okay.
And so last week we talked about it being potentially a data center, because Google actually has a patent on floating data centers. And there's a bit of a question of like how you'd get the data there and stuff. And there's some speculation that you could potentially have it docked somewhere with fiber connected to it. And then if a case evolved where you need to move it, you could.
And just a quick review, why are floating data centers advantageous?
Well, data center needs cooling. Mm-hmm. And so the patent that Google has to do with using seawater for cooling, which does make sense, because if you have a giant body of water, you don't have to worry about, the water will cool itself. Now, of course, you might have environmental changes to some degree.
Yeah.
The secondary thing is that about the transportation, the movement of it. It could be in international waters. So the rules and regulations governing what it can do would be different, and they wouldn't necessarily fall into jurisdiction of the United States or other bodies. So that's kind of interesting. And then you can generate power. And so the power in the network, of course, the issue is at hand. But it's just kind of a neat idea. It also kind of makes it a maybe potentially different target. Anyway, all these kind of ideas.
What do you mean? What?
Well, meaning if you wanted.
You can't just gloss over that.
Well, if you wanted to shut it down, let's say local government decide to shut down a data center of Google's. You know, they could do it with the police force.
Yeah.
And so there's an idea that, you know, if you want a complete independence, that's what you do. Now, those
it's like
ideas.
Pirate radio.
Yeah,
being
sure.
Originally at sea.
Pirate network.
Yeah.
Google is powerful enough, important enough, where I don't see a government actually trying to do anything with them. I mean, basically, if Google went down, you'd have serious governmental problems, right?
Let's pause and think about that for a second and just keep breathing.
So these ideas clearly made it not that good an idea for a data center. It's neat. The other thing about it is it's massive. And for a data center on a barge, you'd think, why not make it a little smaller? It seems kind of top heavy. It's not exactly the seaworthy kind of thing you'd think about. Now, it's in the bay, and there's another one in Maine, in Portland, Maine. And so let me tell a little story about what happened to me this week.
Uncle Lyle.
I finally broke Google Glass. I'm wearing it right now, so it's not totally broken. And by the way, yes, I have heard the story about the woman that got arrested. About 20 people have sent me notes about this woman that got arrested, got ticketed for wearing Google Glass while speeding. So that happened too. But we won't get into that.
That's,
so anyway.
That's a whole other thing.
Totally
though.
Other thing.
You
I'm just going to mention.
Did not break your Google Glass by speeding.
No. Or talking to a woman that had. Or having people complain to me. In any case,
it wasn't a protest.
So Google Glass, of course, is a small computer that I wear on my face. It's got a camera and a screen. And the stem that connects the battery pack, there's a known weakness in the sense that a lot of Google Explorers, the people that are the early adopters like me are called a Google Explorer. We spent a lot of money. Google selected us, then we spent a lot of money, and we got this device. And then we're developing software and exploring it and kind of giving feedback. And I have been doing that. I've been developing an application, and I've been giving feedback when requested about my experience.
Plus, it's lots of fun.
It's lots of fun. And I get to meet a lot of people. That's the biggest thing.
Yeah.
I share it with hundreds and hundreds of people. Okay, so it snaps. And it snapped probably because I put it in a bag in a case in a certain way. In any case, they have a good return policy. I spent enough money where actually I just call them up or contacted them, and then they contacted me, and I had this little back and forth about how to return it. And I could either, I could ship it off to them as an RMA, or I could give them some money and then they'd send me one, and then I wouldn't have to not have one. Anyways, I went through this process of dealing with tech support for Google. Have you ever been on a phone with a Google employee?
No, never.
Right, because they don't do that.
Yeah.
Right. And so the thing about Google has always been this kind of lack of a person. The systems are all done well enough that you don't need help. And in fact, even the help documents are kind of stepping through menu item choices. It's not, it's very much, they try to make their service such that you don't need help. And so having a Google employee, I contacted them through email. They asked when I could, they could call me. They called me. I had another question. They said they'd get back to me. They got back to me. It was an amazing experience. Mm-hmm. It was an amazing experience just like it was when I got Google Glass. When I was invited to get Google Glass, I actually went to the Mountain View headquarters, Googleplex, and walked in, and somebody met me at the front with a tablet. And then she stayed with me the entire time and gave me a 45-minute demo of the product and then walked around the campus a bit to see some of the things at Google. Mm-hmm. It was a very cool experience.
Yeah.
And there were a lot of people in that space. And me being that radio interviewee kind of person, I asked a lot of questions about who she was, where she came from, and all that. I won't divulge who she was. And though Google probably knows who I interacted with, that's kind of creepy. In any case, one of the things I kind of gleaned was that she was a new employee. Yeah. She was hired specifically to do this Google Glass thing. Okay. Yeah. And they have a lot of people of that sort. And they've made it kind of an experience. Okay. So now.
So basically, you had just a great customer service experience with Google Glass, perhaps because you're one of these
definitely
early adopter I'm, explorer types.
Definitely because I'm one of those people. I spend a lot of money. They think of my, I'm to some degree, not that they've said this, I'm to some degree the emissary of Google Glass out in the public. I don't work for Google, but I talk about it, right? That's exactly the kind of thing they want.
Yeah, yeah.
They want this airtime.
Yes. They're doing so well.
That's amazing, isn't it? I pay them and I give them airtime. Oh, ridiculous. I'm doing something wrong, Bunny. So anyway, this week doing that and then looking at that device again, I went, you know, that could be a store. That could be a giant store in San Francisco Bay, this big floating store. And I'm kind of thinking, God, yeah, they have all these people that have been trained with good customer service, and then they're building this giant thing in the same area that they do the interview, you know, that they take people and train them. And they're about to release this product at some point. In fact, they're releasing a new version, which the Explorers will get. Mm-hmm. It's slightly better. It's got audio improvements and stuff. We don't know when that's going to happen. And they're going to give me a new old one before I get a new one. And I get to invite three people to Google Glass to go ahead and spend a lot of money on this. So first off, I want to say right now, I would love to hear your idea on using Google Glass if you'd like to spend the crazy amounts of money to buy it. I will invite you if you're a listener to GeekSpeak and would like to contact me and say, this is my idea. Now, I will not take any proceeds or anything, and it has to be someone that I've got to respect the idea. But please feel free to email Lyle@geekspeak.org, or actually geeks@geekspeak.org, and say, I want to buy Google Glass, and we'll talk. And I've also invited two other faculty members who are getting grants together at UCSC to get Glass. So they're about to expand the program. It was really good customer service. Those customer service people are not available right now, and they're building a giant building in San Francisco and in Maine. I think it's a store. So last night I'm reading...
Hold on.
Yeah.
Your connection to your favorite thing in the world, Google Glass, and that big box in the Bay as a store, frankly, that seems a little thin.
I agree. So here's the title of the article I found last night from CNET. About technology, I always review technology stories to find out what we're going to talk about. San Francisco's Bay Bridge mystery, floating data center, or Google Glass store.
What?
See? Yeah, exactly.
How is that a store?
Well, that's the thing is it's actually the permit they have for it is not a permit structure. It's a temporary structure. It's an event permit structure. So that's how they're building it under this idea that it's a temporary thing.
How do you know that?
Because Real Reporters did that kind of reporting thing that they do. Yeah. So anyway, most likely they're going to have this kind of event space. And I look forward to going. And Bonnie, I'm going to try to bring you along with me if I get invited early on.
Sure, sure. Well, I figure knowing you is, that's, you know, putting up with being wowed by Google Glass is part of the deal.
Yeah, I'm sorry. I feel like a googly kind of person, that's for sure.
Super googly about it.
You know, I bought the Nexus 5, the new Google phone got released, and I bought it. I'll have it in a week or two. I'll be a Google person sucked in. No more iOS for me. It's very sad.
Wait, I thought you just, anyway, we'll get to that later.
All right.
All right, so it's just a story, you guys. There's nothing to worry about.
Yeah, exactly.
Just lots and lots of you just come into the building. Don't be concerned at all.
No, it also might not be a store. We don't know. They're not saying anything.
I don't care. It still seems ominous to me.
All right. I agree.
I'm just going to say that.
Sounds good.
All right. Hey, I've got a question for you, just a quick one. There's something about wine and technology.
Ah, yes, you like wine.
I do like wine.
Are you one of those wine connoisseurs that know when it tastes good and when it tastes bad?
I get that far, yes.
I get that far, too. And my ability to discern whether wine tastes good or not has to do with how much I've had.
Yeah, so. That's true. We usually save the good bottles for the beginning of the evening.
My partner knows wine. And so in the last 4 years, I've learned to know wine better. And I've got to say, I definitely have a taste for it. Going to France a lot, that happens too.
Yeah.
But I don't know how to talk about it. And I don't really
wine
know.
Good.
I don't know how true it actually all is. But one thing you do know is when you have like a bottle of wine and you open it up, you've got a commitment to make at this point.
That yes. You need to get some friends together.
You got to finish that wine.
You got to finish that wine.
Why?
Well, because the wine inside can interact with the oxygen in the air and change character and lose some of its balance and goodness.
Yeah, it continues to oxidate. The oxygen affects the wine taste. And if you've ever taken a bottle of wine that tasted really good and then you put it in, I don't know, your refrigerator for a few days, it didn't taste good anymore.
I remember this tasting differently before.
Yes.
Yeah.
So there's a new thing on the market for wine people, and that is a thing. Let's see, what is it called? It's called Vineage or something.
Oh,
it
sure
doesn't
it
matter
is.
What it is.
Yeah.
Vineage. And it's a cap for the bottle. Okay.
Now, okay, let's before we get to this, some methods already exist for preserving your wine a few days. One is a vacuum cork. So you can use like a cork that doesn't let air.
Like those little pump things.
Like a little pump thing.
Evacuate
and then you can, like,
the air.
Pump the air out. There's also argon gas. There's like a
nitrogen gas. Exactly.
You put in that a, you can put, you know, like fill in some that makes.
You put in a noble gas
layer
of some sort,
a
and nothing
gas.
And nothing interacts anymore.
Yeah.
That's right.
So those two methods already exist to help.
There's another method that the connoisseurs out there don't particularly like. Though there's a kind of a movement to move that direction. That is boxed wine.
Right.
And the reason why boxed wine's potentially nice is that the bag itself just squirts wine out, nothing goes back in.
My partner is on top of this wine box trend. Let me just say that.
Hey, you know what? It makes sense because as I looked at this product that I'm about to talk about, I'm kind of talking about but I haven't yet, I thought, well, that's just like a wine box. Hey. So the idea with the box of wine is you have this bag and no air actually gets in. You just squirt air out and the container actually changes size.
Yeah.
That's a little harder to do with a glass bottle. The bottle doesn't seem to deform very well.
Yeah.
Even if you suck the air out, in fact, it holds its atmospheric condition. So they have this thing that you pop on the top, okay? This is what the device does.
Okay.
It lets wine go out. You put a little cartridge bag inside it. A bag fills the container with itself as the water goes out. So imagine you take a balloon and you stick it at the nozzle of a wine bottle and put a straw next to it. And then you suck the wine out of that bottle. Mmm, tasty. The bag will actually expand out, filling the bottle with air.
You're making a wine bladder.
It's a wine bladder. It's an inverted wine box inside a bottle. And it's every cartridge is a one-time use. Kind of disgusting, but it gave me a chance to talk about wine. So, I'll put the pictures up at geekspeak.org.
Okay, but maybe this will count as our geek bit.
I think it will be.
Happen today.
Absolutely.
Okay, it looks weird. I'm just going to vouch for it being weird. Hey, let's talk more about stuff when we come back. There's a crazy new virus I want to hear about. So.
Oh, yeah. Okay, in just a minute.
Okay. Well, guess what? You're listening to Geek Speak on KUSP. I'm Bonnie Jean Primsch, and with me in their air room is Lyle Troxell. Next time, by the way, on one of our favorite shows, the 7th Avenue Project, that airs Sundays at noon. It is another fine show from KUSP's Robert Pauly, this time facing life sentences in a maximum security prison. A group of inmates struggle to find meaning through art and fellowship in the new documentary, At Night I Fly. The film has its West Coast premiere in Santa Cruz this month, and KUSP's Robert Pauly will talk to director Michelle Venzer all about it. That's on the 7th Avenue Project tomorrow, Sunday, at high noon on 88.9 KUSP. That's tune-in radio, ladies and gentlemen. That's good stuff.
Good stuff.
Yeah.
So I did Halloween candy, you know, this last couple days with my kids. And I mean, I did Halloween, trick-or-treating, all that, but mostly became candy really quickly.
Candy.
Lots of candy. And I'm, you know, I'm a zero-carb kind of person, so candy not so much. My kids love it.
Did you go on a binge then the past couple
days? No candy. I've had no candy at all.
What? How did you do it?
I just did it, and I'm surrounded by it. It's hard.
My honey and I, we got like a big bag of Halloween candy. I'm not sure if it lasted to Halloween.
Yeah. That's, well, it's so, it's, you know, it's... The way to do it really is to buy it the day after, because it's really cheap then, and you can really destroy yourself.
I should have done that.
So I was doing some Google search, like what to do with candy. You know, one of these ideas that a friend kind of first back is just go to your kids and go, "I'll buy your candy off you. Here's a 20. Give me your bag." Yeah, that doesn't work. I don't know if you knew that. No.
No, candy, I have to up that. Way more valuable.
I think my son would do it for Google Glass, probably.
Yeah.
But I was doing a little search on it and caught this great little art project you can do. It has nothing to do with getting rid of candy, because all you actually need is the empty boxes. But this is a geek bit, I guess, because it's a visual thing we'll put up in the
website. All right, we do have a geek bit.
It's just making magnets out of candy boxes.
What a fun idea.
Don't you want to kind of do that now?
I kind of do. You know what? They don't have to be empty, I wouldn't think, if they were lightweight candies.
Yes. Yeah.
Or very strong magnets.
So basically, you take those strong magnets and take the candy boxes and just make them magnet fridges.
Now, how many candy boxes did you get in that? Because I see
no
a lot
idea.
Of fun-sized bags. And
It's crazy amounts, and it's being ripped through quickly.
Yeah.
So. Anyway, let's go on to this virus thing you're talking about.
Yeah, okay, so there's some kind of insane virus out there. What is this thing?
This thing is technically fantastic and horrible at the same time. It's actually, so we all know what a virus is. A virus is a piece of software that runs on your computer that you don't want running on your computer. That's all. Mm-hmm. And normally, the reason we call them computer viruses is they seem to spread by themselves. They have a methodology for moving between machines.
Yeah.
And the very early viruses were novelty and interesting, because they all of a sudden were on computers and they do something completely trivial and non-threatening, non-damaging. And then there was a period of time in the late 90s and early aughts where the viruses were just mean.
Vicious.
Just mean.
Yeah, it's mean.
You know, like bad graffiti kind of viruses where it wasn't anything about destroying, but destroying something beautiful. You know, that was all it was about. And there was a virus that went out and found all MP3s and deleted them, and or all audio files and deleted. Just really nasty stuff.
Yeah.
Commonly, viruses will actually accidentally damage stuff. But over the years, we've seen flexes on what kind of things are desirable. There was a period of time where what we really wanted is, people wanted, the virus makers wanted, were zombie PCs. And what they did, these giant networks of computers that were controlled by their virus software, they would then use that power of that computing for different things.
Yeah.
Sometimes nefarious, like
their own evil ends.
Yes. Yeah. Sometimes taking a bank down or a website down and saying, you know, this website will not operate. What's called a denial of service attack. You'd have a whole bunch of computers basically asking for the website at the same time, and then the real people couldn't get to it.
Right.
And then they'd send a note to that company saying, you'll stay offline until we decide that you will be online again. And hey, you know, it's Black Friday tomorrow and you probably want to pay us $10,000. And so that was what they were doing.
Wow.
And it was a pretty successful business. And the net in general, the community online actually started producing companies that would protect you from this. So there's actually denial of service protection companies.
Mm-hmm.
Kind of this week, Google actually announced that they are throwing some of their extra resources at protecting free speech sites that get denial of service on them.
Should we just change the name of the show to Google
Speak? Maybe. We've done Apple for so long, man, I gotta say. Moving on. So the next threat for viruses was identity theft. The big thing was basically logging into your machine and then from your computer having access and getting into your bank account records or login information and then later stealing money from your bank account directly. And now the newest and greatest and horriblest is the one I'm talking about now.
Horriblest.
This thing is called the Crypto Locker.
Ooh.
And it's a ransomware virus. The idea is that it will do something to you and then it will make you pay. And this is how it works. So on your computer, what's important on your computer? If your hard drive, when your hard drive fails, what would you be missing?
The photos and music.
Yeah, pretty important.
And some of my work files.
And some work files. No, so that's the third one, but that's interesting.
Well, we also have they have a cloud-based solution.
Yes, so those are safe.
Yeah.
So if I were to, so this virus, this Crypto Locker, it tries to get on your computer, and it can get on your computer for many ways. The best way for it to get on your computer right now is simply a friend will send you something and you will click on that link and your machine will get infected.
Mm-hmm.
And that's traditionally a common vector for viruses.
Don't click on the links.
The general thought is, if somebody sent you something, if it's being given to you, do not do it. You only open stuff that you go get yourself. So let's say your bank sends you a note saying, oh my gosh, a deposit's been made into your account of this amount of money, or some money has been subtracted from your account. That email can notify you that there's something going on, but do not use that email for anything.
Mm-hmm.
Now go open a browser and open your website, open the bank directly. That's the kind of thing you want to avoid.
Yeah.
Because this virus is really, really bad and it's spreading really quickly.
Mm-hmm.
And here's how it works. It gets on your computer and runs. And what it does is it starts by grabbing a public key.
Mm-hmm.
A private and public. Okay, let's go back to security real quick for a second. This concept that I can
security
have a key
review.
And you can have a key.
Yeah.
And these are paired sets so that if I encrypt something with mine, you can decrypt it with yours.
Mm-hmm.
So therefore, I can give you stuff that only you can open.
Right.
that's, I won't get into details, but the basic
thing that happens.
So take these two keys, put one on a server someplace, put the other one on top of the computer. The virus puts it on your computer. It then opens every one of your files on your computer and encrypts it with a strong algorithm and then resaves the file. After it's done with that, it erases the encryption key. And now you cannot get access to your files. It then pops up a dialog and says, if you want your files, you have 72 hours to pay us $300. If you don't do this...
That's just straight up rude.
Yes. If you don't do this, we will erase that key on that server. That server's going to be erased in 72 hours.
Yeah.
Like, gone. And you will never get your data back. And it's been investigated and stuff. Yeah, sure enough, what they're doing is completely accurate technically. Once they've encrypted your files without that key that's on this other server, you cannot get your data back. It's gone.
Yeah.
So... the $300 you pay in some anonymous way. You buy gift cards, things of that nature. And there's instructions in this document on how to do it.
You must do it this way.
Yeah, the English is horrible. Here's the big alert that shows up. It's a big red warning. It's got a timer going. Oh, it says 95 hours left. Okay. Your important files, encryption produced on this computer, photos, videos, documents, etc. Here is a complete list of encrypted files, and you can personally verify this. Encryption was produced using unique public key. Generated for this computer. To decrypt files, you must obtain the private key. The single copy of the private key, which will allow you to decrypt the files located on the secrets. And it's like not written very well.
Yeah.
That's the general idea. And then there's all instructions on how to pay them. Now, hopefully, if you get this, if this happens to you, you have to decide if you want your files or not. And if you do, you've got to pay the ransom. There's no way to get them technically from your computer.
We haven't come up with a fix, a workaround.
There's never going to be a fix or workaround. This is we as a society have decided to make really good encryption, and they're using the best encryption. It's all open source and open standards, and they're using it, and therefore, without that private key, nothing you can do.
Okay.
Now, you can protect your computer. You can go offline and never be online again, and you'll be okay. You could, this is only a Windows problem.
Wait. It's like once you already have virus?
Before you have it. Why I'm suggesting you do something now.
Okay.
If you've got a Windows machine, you do not want this virus. If you get this virus, you will have to pay.
I sort of want to turn my computer off right now.
It's kind of like that, exactly.
I
was relieved
out.
To see that it was Windows only. So you don't want to get the virus, obviously. You do not want to open things in your email. Do not. If somebody sends you something, don't open it. Call them on the phone or respond back saying, sorry, I don't open attachments.
Yeah.
Thank you.
Yeah.
Also, do not use Internet Explorer to browse the web. There's always vulnerabilities in that. Try to use Chrome or Firefox and make sure your stuff is updated.
So I'm okay.
These will limit the amount. The other thing you can do is have an offline backup. Now, here's the thing about backups. Let's say right now you got a hard drive out. You connect to your computer and you did a full backup. And then you disconnect that hard drive.
Yeah.
Then you got your virus.
Yeah.
You're good.
Yeah.
Right? Because the hard drive's fine. If you keep that hard drive connected, however, the virus will go look in that hard drive and encrypt all those files too.
Okay.
Yeah.
That's a good tip.
So that's a problem.
Yeah.
Cloud backup is kind of one of those great solutions in this situation. Dropbox, all your files will get encrypted and put back on Dropbox, which would be a problem. Dropbox does have some revision control, which means you could go back up and potentially revert the file. So maybe that would help, but it could be problematic.
Wait. So if I had already put my files on, say, Dropbox.
The way Dropbox works is actually makes a folder in your computer.
Yeah.
Get synced automatically to Dropbox. So it looks like files on your computer.
Oh.
And as you change your files, Dropbox in the background is uploading them and
so
putting
them
on the server.
So that auto-sync is a problem.
Well, it is, right? Because if you have your file that's a photo of your candy collection for Halloween, and then this application, this virus goes and encrypts that file, now it looks like random noise. You can't do anything with it.
Yeah.
Then Dropbox friendly goes, oh, it's been changed, grabs the file, uploads it to the server, and writes it. Now, Dropbox also does have some revision. You can actually step through some of your history. So you might be able to go back up to Dropbox web interface and find the file before it was encrypted and get it.
Okay.
But
they have cached copies.
Yeah, they have cached copies. But that amount of backup they have of that sort has to do with the contract you have with them, how much storage you have, and what they feel is right.
So get right with Dropbox.
Yeah.
When you update, then unplug that hard drive
so it's not
still connected.
Yeah. Now, Google Drive, you're going to be totally fine on.
That's a one-time
And then anything like something like that scans your computer and backs up your whole computer and then keeps copies over a period of time, you're okay. Mm-hmm. Because this window of operation is 95 hours. You're going to only, you'll be notified and you'll have some time as long as during that time you can get your, turn your machine off, shut down, all that. Mm-hmm. So, the thing to do is not get this virus.
Yeah.
you should have backups and you should have them disconnected, which is a shame because we keep on recommending on GeekSpeak when you do your backups to have them automated because you don't want to think about it.
Right.
This is right now because of the trend of time.
It's a bad time for that idea.
You really want to get, and you know, I have friends that still burn DVDs and CDs and stuff of their files. Mm-hmm. It's really nice because that you can't change that file after you've written it.
Yeah.
So that's a really, if really important stuff, I want to do that. You'd want
to
do that.
You might have to get old school about it.
Yeah. Now I have hundreds of gigs of a terabyte of photos. Mm-hmm. So I can't really burn this to disk. It's not feasible. So I definitely turned off my NAS last night.
Yeah.
And I removed, from my Windows machine, I removed my password saving so that I can't connect to that NAS without doing it manually.
Yeah.
Okay. Which means my Windows machine's not being backed up automatically right now. But this thing is called CryptoLocker. It's called ransomware. There's a really interesting article about it. If you want to learn more about the details, we'll have it linked at geekspeak.org.
Is there any hint about what sorts of things you'd click on that might be CryptoLocker engagers?
Anything that I would suggest, right now there's an email that's kind of coming around that's doing this, and I'm not sure the format, but this will change dynamically.
Yeah.
It's getting, they're making a lot of money.
But do they have a similar tone?
No.
Do you know what I mean?
No.
Like it usually looks like, I thought you might want to look at this, and then there's a link, obviously.
I never open something somebody emails me.
Yeah.
I just don't do it.
Yeah.
And it's tricky, of course, because in business, lots of times somebody will send you something that needs to be sent. And in that situation, you really want to make sure that it's something that you know what the file is. As a geek, I can kind of inspect it and take a look at it.
Mm-hmm.
The trick is not to actually run it. And so your email client, when an attachment is sent to you, is actually saving that document on your file system inside a certain folder.
Mm-hmm.
And you can actually go in that folder and look at it and see what type of document it is. The trick about this is that the amount of knowledge necessary to detect whether it's safe or not is too great for the average person.
Mm-hmm.
I have been, you know, I can be fooled easily.
Yeah.
So you really just can't click on stuff. And you cannot.
So it could be within a comprehensible email clearly from someone that you know using their language, and there'd be a link on it, and the caution is don't click on that link.
Yeah. So there are known vulnerabilities in systems all the time. And this is just the way complex systems work. So even with your browser, even with your best browser of choice, you can go to a website and have that potentially install stuff on your computer. So even opening a web page of a certain type could be problematic. Now, web pages are actually written by human beings, and human beings have access to them, and therefore there's a vulnerability there for the human being to be taken advantage of.
Mm-hmm.
So let's say geekspeak.org. Mm-hmm. I was developing code last night for geekspeak.org. I was doing it from a Macintosh. But theoretically, somebody could have had virus on my computer. When I upgraded the GeekSpeak website, code was inserted in there that would trick some browsers into downloading this virus. I cannot guarantee that didn't happen. I'm almost sure it didn't happen.
Mm-hmm.
I'm pretty knowledgeable. It's on an Ubuntu machine. I was connected to SSH. I have my own scripts to do this. I have a very complicated structure to do this, but it doesn't mean I didn't make a mistake or someone's not targeting us for some reason. There's not a lot of traffic on geekspeak.org, so I'm not worried about it. But the point is that going to a website that's just a knowledge website potentially could have a vulnerability. And this is where...
Going to a website that's just a knowledge website. What do you mean, just a knowledge website?
Meaning not even downloading an application or anything. Just going to... I don't mean to scare people, but going to somebody's...
Well, this is very freaky,
well, going
Lyle,
to somebody's.
I'm not hearing anything specific enough that lets me know what to look for.
The web is not a safe place. It's a hostile environment. And we tend to think of it as fun and friendly and easy.
Ooh.
But the truth is, it's just a matter of time before something happens.
Before the whole thing becomes Craigslist.
It's already... Yeah, exactly. You've got to be really skeptical about what's happening.
Oh,
and you have to understand that the systems that are sending emails are getting better and better at emulating human beings. You don't know. So I don't have a good answer except for to say, get your private data removed from your computer. Understand that any time your computer could do things you don't want it to do.
Yeah.
And move through life with caution.
Great. Great, Lyle.
It's like if you're mountain climbing, you stay tethered to the line, you know?
Yeah.
I mean, I don't mean to be depressing. I'm sorry, Bonnie.
But it doesn't sound like there's a lot of room to move. Like, I can't flirt with my honey by like, hey, here's a link you should check out. I can't
do
that.
Get a tablet device and, I mean, they're safer.
Are they?
Yeah.
Oh, gosh.
Yeah, because so they're locked down more. I mean, that's one of the things that's going on with these new operating systems. You're seeing more and more thoughts about the operating system protecting the user from bad things.
Gosh.
And it means less freedom as a computer user, which I hate, but it means less heartache and pain on losing content. And I don't want people losing their photos.
Okay. It's just a matter of time before we're allowed to pack liquids on the plane.
Yeah.
Oh, wait.
Don't put liquids in your computer either.
Don't put liquids in your computer. That's never been a good idea. Well, now that I'm thoroughly disheartened.
Oh, man, I'm sorry.
Oh, jeez. On the same hand, I've heard that it's possible to just say goodbye to passwords in general. Now, this flies in the face of all the caution that you were just...
You know, it actually is an extension to some degree, and that is that, you know, you see me as a computer expert. I've been doing the show for 13 years.
Yeah.
This is what I do.
Yeah.
And I'm saying, yeah, you don't have an answer here. You got to be really careful.
Yeah.
And even then, make sure you have a backup, because you won't be careful enough, your computer will be taken over.
Right.
And I just don't have a lot. Now, I can also say, get on an Ubuntu machine, it'll be safer. Get on a Macintosh, you won't have this problem with the virus. You know, you're in bad shape compared to me because I happen to be on a Mac.
Yeah, here I am.
For
on
right
my
now.
ThinkPad.
In the future, it'll change.
Yikes.
But, yeah. So.
So what's S-Q-R-L?
Passwords. Yeah, squirrel. You know what a QR code is?
I need a review.
Okay. QR code is a printed icon.
Oh, that's that weird blocky thing.
Yeah, can you describe it? It looks like kind of snow from a TV, but it's got a pattern to it.
It looks a little bit like a UPC symbol, but instead of stripies, it's a bunch of random blocks, and it's like this cube, and people are just, you know, they're breathless with just being hot to bother about these things. And you'll see them on like postcards, like just put your phone over this and you'll get more information.
Right.
And it'll send you to a website or something.
Yeah, exactly.
Which now could be a virus.
Yeah. So, absolutely.
Do not
scan QR codes.
Oh, my God.
Oh, so we should just go bury ourselves in the sand. So, a QR code is a visual representation of data that a camera, phone can pick up, and lots of devices can't. So, the computer can very quickly translate that image into data, and normally it's text or a number. Mm-hmm. And it's very common to have it be a URL. So, and an address book. Like, my work business card on the back of it has a QR code. When you scan that, all the data on the card is in text form. It's really convenient. You know, it's really kind of nice.
Yeah.
So the QR code is becoming kind of ubiquitous because we all have smartphones that have cameras and can actually scan them and use them. So there's we have a new era where it's extremely easy to pull something out of your hand and use it to click on something.
Mm-hmm.
Okay?
Mm-hmm.
And that's interesting because you don't have to then type in a username or password or something. You could just have that an image that would represent some unique experience.
Okay.
So SQRL, squirrel, is secure, quick, reliable login. It uses a QR and QR code. And the general concept is kind of complicated, but I thought I'd walk through it with you, Bonnie, and we'll see if we can get to a conclusion of how it works.
All right.
And so let me start with saying that when you go to a website, the first time you visit a website, it's very common for the website to actually start a unique identification with you.
Mm-hmm.
And the way they do that is they create some random number on their server, and they hold on to it, and then they take that random number and they put it in a cookie and they send it to your browser, and your browser stores it temporarily. Now, if you visit their website again, you send that unique number, and they can go, "Oh, I know who that is. That's this unique number."
Okay.
So it's identification for you.
Yeah,
it's confirmation of who you, of the visit you're currently.
It's a way for them to give me the secret code to get into
to
their
do
stuff.
Whatever. Right. So this key is basically session management and manages your session.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. When you go to your favorite website and log in, go to geekspeak.org and log in. Now you get to log in. Other people don't get to log in to geekspeak. We won't use that. We use Gmail.
Okay.
So when you go in and you put your username and your password there, and you push save, you take that information, you send it to them.
Yeah.
They look that up and see if it confirms to the system they have. And they go, "Oh, this is the Bonnie we've seen before." Then they attach that "this is the Bonnie we've seen" kind of reference on the server to that unique number, and they send you back just that number, that same number.
Mm-hmm.
Then every time you visit, you send them this new session variable, and they know that's the Bonnie that logged in.
Yeah.
That's why username and passwords are so important. It validates, it authenticates the session.
Right.
Okay. But you have to know a username and password. And the reason this ties in with this computer overwhelm is that computers are good enough now where they can figure out your password. If you can memorize it, they can figure it out.
The levels of stepping up the game on how to have a secure password, that we've discussed on this show, it's gotten hilarious.
It's gotten ridiculous, exactly.
So,
I mean, one thing is you can't...
There's no way to actually keep those in your... You
right.
can't just like...
Like one of the things that goes on is you have to have a unique password for every website you visit.
Mm-hmm.
And they shouldn't be able to, if one company figures out what your password is because they look at it and they get broken into, they shouldn't be able to derive what your other passwords are. So they need to be unique and not recreatable from some knowledge that you have of having one.
Right.
It's complicated.
So then it's not useful, really.
Yeah, and the basic tenet here, we've talked a lot about this, is that if you think you're being clever with your password, you're wrong. Because what's happened is millions of people's passwords have been looked at and dissected, and the patterns of a human being is not actually as complicated as you think. And therefore, there's actually a small subset of passwords we actually use. So all those security guru people go, you need to have a random 20-character password you can't memorize. Mm-hmm. Good luck with that. And you need to have one for every site you use.
Right.
So it's ridiculous. So the only thing you can do potentially is have a piece of software that helps you with this.
Now, is Squirrel new? Is that a new thing?
Completely new. It totally changes the paradigm. So I'm getting to it. I know it takes a while, but maybe
Yeah, let's get to it in a bit here because we want to let you know about other things going on here at the station. This is Geek Speak. You're listening to Lyle Troxell and Bonnie Primsch in Very Worrisome Discussion. We're going to have to start providing musical information about what we use for our interstitial music. What was that?
Exactly.
I don't know. It's amazing. Hey, guys, you're listening to Geek Speak here on 88.9 KUSP. My name is Bonnie Primsch, also here. Lyle Troxell doing most of the explaining. My job is to go, what?
What? All right.
So back
to sessions.
Yeah.
Normally, you validate who you are by using username and password. The trick about that is that for you to validate who you are, you have to know something that they know. Okay?
Yeah.
So therefore, you have to be registered. They are the company, the website you're going to.
That's like what's your mother's maiden name, all that stuff.
That kind of stuff, right. Mm-hmm. But the idea here is that they have a secret that they have shared with you, and they have it and you have it. And as long as you guys together keep it secret, which is difficult, we can identify you all the time.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. The interesting thing there is that the ownership of that identity and the who you are from a perspective of them is on their side. They decide who you are as long as you match their criteria.
Yeah.
You don't identify yourself. You match their identification of you.
Mm.
Okay? The ownership, the power is in their hands.
Okay. Yeah.
So with all those passwords and crazy things, the solution to that problem is you go get a management software solution that you trust. I use 1Password. It's a paid application. LastPass is another common one. Both of these basically build a secure database on your computer and your phone and allow you to sync your content so that when you're out and about and you need to log into some website, you look it up in this password protective software on your phone or on your computer. You get this crazy string that you could never memorize and you copy it and you paste it in. Or sometimes you have to hand type it. It's kind of annoying.
Mm.
But we're basically using the power of a computer to augment the weakness of the human brain of memorizing passwords,
yeah,
which is a really good thing for computers.
The mini server in your computer does the memorizing for you.
Yes, which makes a lot of sense,
yeah,
right?
Yeah.
You want to memorize numbers, you open a Excel spreadsheet. Now, let me tie this back to just one other thing kind of tangential to this, and that is that I've lost my train of thought. See, okay. I need a computer to help me along.
Yeah.
Okay. You know that Big Blue, Deep Blue, what is it, the computer that IBM made?
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Can beat a human player at chess.
Right.
And that's always news, and it's always really interesting. We have the ability for a computer to beat a human being. We knew it was a matter of time. It gets better. Players get better, whatever. Mm-hmm. But do you know that right now, if you take that expert chess player and you give them a laptop with some software on it, they will beat the computer every time?
Oh, I didn't know that.
Just an average laptop. Like
what do you
have
mean,
in front
like
of you?
Some software on it? Like
some chess helping software. Some software that does similar things to what the computer can do, plus the human's intuition and skill will beat the computer.
Hmm. Okay.
And that makes sense to some degree, even though it's a supercomputer versus a general laptop. But the point is that augmented human experience, you know, can be really powerful.
Yeah.
Okay. So the human has some value in
yes.
there. But
yes.
So does the computer system.
Which is why we're all headed for, what is that, bionic. We're going to be bionic.
Yeah, I already am.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. So.
Cool.
Well, I got metal in me too.
Yeah.
All right. So. Okay. So now what Squirrel does. When the website decides to show you the login, password, and username, instead of doing that, it also creates a random number for you and recognizes that that represents your session, the same thing it did before.
Okay.
But now what it does is it produces a QR code for you, which has that random number plus the domain name that they're at. Okay. Mm-hmm.
So instead of saying, here's your complicated password to type in, here's your image to just make a note of and spit back at me
right.
at some point.
So now this image shows up. Now you take out your trusted piece of software. This will be a SQL application, a Squirrel application on your cell phone
mm-hmm.
that will manage your identity for you. This is the helping hand that you have to trust with the system
yeah,
to work.
Yeah, I just got a little lurch.
It's a little, But the point is, like, right now you can't trust your human mind to memorize things. You have to really trust software. Therefore, you might as well have one you trust with a personal device. That's the general idea. So now, what this actually uses is private and public keys. The same thing that's really good, and in fact so good that people are making $300 a pop off of encrypting your hard drive from the story before. What it does is, when you launch Squirrel, you create a private and public ID. An identification. And the public key you can give to anybody you want, and that is actually what they will store to recognize you. You decide what it is and you give it to them. Okay. All right. When you see that QR code, you scan it with this application. It takes that random number that they have a copy of, they've only shown to you. They know you've only shown it to you. You take a picture of it. You sign that with your private key, this key that you'll never give to anybody. You encryptically sign it, basically saying, this was seen by me.
And no one else has a copy of that.
No one else has a copy of that key, except you can share it with your friends, your partners if you want. You can share this to be represent, like if you want your lawyer to have rights to be able to act like you, you can share it. Mm-hmm. And you can print it out and save it as well for security and put it in a bank vault and all that. So this number that you're going to have, this private key is very important to keep secret. So then the software takes that, looks at the URL that was asked for, the session state and all that information, and then signs it with your private key, takes your public key and sends, and then makes the request to the server with that information. What that does is the server on the back end is waiting for a response, and it sees a copy of that number it just gave out with a signature that's only from you. And it knows it's from you because that public ID key that you hand back with it, it has that on record and recognizes that as Bonnie. You've registered before and given it to them.
So the QR is just another layer.
It's another layer, but there's no password involved. Because your secret is not shared with them. This is the truth, the trick about this.
But how is it easier? Because this sounds like a bajillion step process.
Because the complicated part the computer does for you. So what you do when you want to log into your account, you go log into your account, you go to a website that has your username and password. Right next to it is this little tiny QR code. You pull out your phone and you click scan and you click go. Uh-huh. And then the website you visited first where you wanted to log in is now logged in. That's all you have to do. No passwords, no typing. You take a picture and you say go. And then the websites, and the authentication happens in a second channel, meaning you access a website with your desktop computer, but you confirm your authentication and identity through a secondary means, through your phone. Therefore, if someone's listening in on it, they don't know how it worked. You can now go to a public kiosk, even if everything's...
People can be watching you do it.
Doesn't matter.
Okay.
Because that thing is only used one time, and no one gets that private key. Only you have the private key, and the signature of that is for a one-time use of that one QR code, and the only people that get that is the website you're trying to log into.
So who's using this? How
so it's brand
effective
new.
Is this?
It's brand new. It's been, it was kind of invented by this guy named Steve Gibson, who's a security expert that I listen to and follow and actually buy software from. He's actually a hard drive expert, too. He's a really great guy. He gives this whole thing away. He realized that now with us having personal devices, this is a technology we can use and kind of invented the scheme. And there's hundreds of people developing software around it. So you will start seeing Squirrel.
So there's an open source community Absolutely. Around this concept of having high security.
Yes. And having your phone be the ownership of your identity.
Your phone being the ownership of
now,
your
Now, this identity. Software can also run on a desktop machine as well or a tablet. So you can actually move it around. And the software that you'll be running will actually be able to move your key around and keep it private and keep it signed and all that.
So you can use it on all of your screens.
You will also have to have a very complicated password that protects that key on your phone.
Which somebody else generates?
You'll have to deal with a good password, but there's only be one that you have to memorize. And what I would recommend is you generate a random number and then you write it down with a pen on a piece of paper and you save it somewhere that you know where it is. Maybe you rip it in half and give half to your mom and half to your brother, and then if everything happens, they can get together and actually access your identity, right? There's things of that nature that are needed.
That's
to
more scavenger hunting anyway. It's just
bit.
More fun.
Yeah,
so, okay, so basically what you're talking about is with one complicated password that you make up and then store safely in some way and a phone... You can use that complicated password plus your phone
and this code that you generate
with these QR codes. Mm-hmm. Okay, and so websites don't have to know about the QR code.
So websites do. So that's the trick.
Websites have
to start supporting this technology, and at the same time, the phones you have to get an application that supports it. The application, I don't think there's one out right now. I will be implementing. Like I work for
a
company.
It's brand new.
It's brand new.
Like
two weeks
is an idea.
2 weeks
somebody came
or so.
Up.
Yeah, okay. I've heard about it 3 weeks ago.
Okay.
It sounds really good. It's getting better. But the point is that we do have solutions to these hard problems. We've been talking about passwords being problematic for a long time, and we don't have good solutions except for weird systems that are kind of hard to use. Yeah. And the truth is, technology advances, it gets better. Viruses are going to be the same way, right? Computer systems will get better. It's optimistic, I think.
We're just sort of an awkward teenage moment around
to some degree.
Security.
We are. Yeah, absolutely. Okay. The other thing that's interesting about this QR code is the ownership of the identity is yours, not the website. In fact, the website has no secrets about you. It only has public information about you.
Oh.
And that's really interesting because it does. You don't have to trust they're going to keep a secret. All they have.
Well, why would websites then? I mean, if websites are using information about you to properly direct advertisers to your face.
So they're still going to want to do that.
Why would they put up with this QR thing?
That's a very good point. In that you come along and you say, this is my number and this is who I am and I want to log in. And they say, neat. All we know about you is a number. So you've started an initiation with us. We now know how to identify you. We know how to recognize your uniqueness, and you confirm that. That's great. Now, please tell me some stuff about yourself and why I should pay attention to you. So then you give them your first name and your last name, and you give them your email address. That would be not necessarily to use the systems, but it would be necessary for them to know they want to serve you.
A website still could say, okay, that's nice, and you get at this content once we know a little bit more about you.
But the point is that they don't have to make up some user ID or let you make up a user ID that identifies you and a password and keep that secret or keep that in their system. You decide what your secret is with you, and you just always tell them who you are cryptically, safely. So there's a bit of power switch.
I don't see it.
It's conceptual to some degree. Right now, your Google password, two people know that.
Yeah.
You know it, and Google knows it.
Yeah.
If Google makes a mistake and other people know it, those people can take advantage of you.
Right.
Therefore, it's completely out of your control whether you are the only one that can log into that Google account.
Okay.
It has to do with them having a secret that you share.
And so how's that different with
this
Squirrel?
New system, they don't have a secret about you. They have no secret about you necessarily.
So the other people could tap Google and go, ha-ha, and then they'd find
they
out
wouldn't be able
no
to log
way
in as
to
you.
Get at us.
That's right. The only way to confirm that you're you is by having that application on your phone, that little tiny thing.
Thank you. That clarified
So that's part of it.
All right.
We'll see how this progresses.
I mean,
passwords
it seems like
are going
a
away.
Long shot, a little bit like the Hyperloop.
It's
a nice idea, but I don't know if it's really going to happen.
The Hyperloop is the potential giant. We have a whole show on this, which was fantastic.
Yeah, it was a fun show.
It's basically a pneumatic tube for people that runs the length of California. Mm-hmm. And theoretically, I think a couple hours to get to Los Angeles from San Francisco.
Right. So yeah. Elon Musk came up with this and he thought, here's your high-speed rail. Ha! Do this instead. And, you know, it got a lot of news. But then there was the question like, okay, well, so what? Like people, he's not throwing money behind this. So
what point
Hyperloop was kind of the prevailing question there.
Yeah. So what's happened this week, which is really interesting, is that a new company has emerged that will attempt within 18 months to have a prototype running with people in it.
Really?
Yeah.
And is it an Elon Musk connected company?
He's definitely there.
Well, you'd want the brain on the project,
I would think. I mean, I don't think he technically is actually invested in this one, but it's definitely his baby, so he's going to care. And I'm assuming if they need help, he'd step in.
Yeah. So who's
the company's called Jump Start Fund, and the Dick Ereborn is the CEO. Dirk Ereborn is the CEO and co-founder. He says, we want to be the ones that actually make this happen. Mm-hmm. And continues, quote, so of course we need to create a corporation. Whoever decides to dedicate more time in this than just logging into the platform deserves to be part of the company. So basically, he's inviting people to participate. And actually,
he's going to open source his way to a prototype?
It's definitely jump aboard, let's make this happen.
Jump
kind of
aboard.
Thing.
Yeah, come on in, the water's fine. So there's sort of a wisdom of the crowds effect that he's hoping for there.
Yeah, exactly.
Wow.
And yeah,
of people sort of opting in, interested parties.
And the company is called Jump Start Fund, and it's ideas powered by the crowd is the space that this is being funded and started by. And the Hyperloop is one of the first ones to start happening.
Fascinating.
It's kind of cool.
So I'm just, okay, so we'll have an article about that on our website.
Yeah, it's a wonderful article about it. And another update on Elon Musk, since we're talking about Elon Musk.
Yeah, let's get the general Elon Musk update. And now for Elon Musk update on GeekSpeak.
So do you remember the Spy Who Loved Me, the James Bond film?
Sure.
And do you remember in The Spy Who Loved Me, there's a white Lotus Esprit car that goes into the water and becomes a submarine?
Oh, yeah. Someone's making that, right? Aren't they?
Elon Musk, of course.
Elon. That's right. Now, we covered this a little bit while you were gone.
Oh, did we? Oh,
we
okay.
Did.
I'm so sorry.
It's nice to know you know it, too.
Yeah. I just like the...
That he's just going to make it. Like, yeah, well, if not him, who?
Exactly.
Really?
Exactly.
And I got into a rant about, you know, how it's important for the people with money and creativity to go ahead and spend it on potentially frivolous things because then they get a chance to exist. Otherwise, they would never exist.
That's right.
So
do I,
aces for him.
Do I have time, Bonnie, to talk about operating system upgrades?
Yeah, you got a minute or so.
All right. So
So you're going to upgrade?
Well, so last week
there was a talk about the potentially upgrading, and you weren't sure, but it turns out Miles wrote us and said, "Yeah, actually, Mavericks is a good way in."
Exactly.
What does he mean?
Mavericks, so Mavericks is the newest operating system. It's 10.9. Oh, Macintosh OS 10.9.
Okay.
And 10.8 was the earlier one. It was Mountain Lion. Before that was Lion. In fact, all of them have named cats until now. It's named after Santa Cruz Ocean.
Is it, yeah, is it about the symbol
has ocean waves in it. So
okay,
yeah,
so it's, the
it's
surf
named
spot.
After Santa Cruz, which
okay,
is awesome.
That's kind of cool.
Mavericks is a surfing spot here in Santa Cruz. And in any case, the Mavericks operating system, a new update. It's free for Macintosh users, which was completely new. And it comes with a whole bunch of the Office suite. New computers come with the Office suite. So basically, they're giving away software for free. That's, we talked about that last week.
Yeah.
But I said to Ben, great, you're recommending everybody does this. We're going to get calls next week. Oh, wait, Rick's not in town. That's great. Email Ben, right?
Yeah.
There hasn't been a lot of complaints. So one thing you never want to do is when you're about to do something with your computer, you don't want to upgrade at that point. That's a bad idea.
When you're about to do something with your computer.
Let's say you're about to, I don't know, do a radio show.
Oh, okay.
An hour before that, upgrading your computer would be insane.
That's a silly idea.
But I decided it'd be a better story if I actually crashed my computer upgrading to Mavericks right before GeekSpeak. Well, guess what? It didn't crash. It was really easy. It took about 15 minutes.
Okay.
Downloaded the 3-gig file at home on a good network. And went through the whole process, and I haven't had any problems yet. Really simple to do. I highly recommend upgrading OS 10 to OS 10.9 if you can.
Okay, because it's easy to do.
It's easy to do, and Miles, who I trust very much, yeah, says it's a great operating system. So
okay,
it's good,
so he's checked it out for us.
I don't know, because it's only been a few minutes.
All right. Well, this has been GeekSpeak for November 2nd, 2013. GeekSpeak is a registered service mark of David Lawrence and is used with permission. This is 88.9 KUSP Public Radio and KUSP.org. To find out more about this or any episode of GeekSpeak, please visit GeekSpeak.org. And by the way, we're a Creative Commons Attribution 3.0, so feel free to reuse our stuff any way you like. And thank you for listening. This has been Bonnie Jean Primsch and Lyle Troxell.
We'll see you next week, right?
Yeah.
Absolutely. Thanks, Bonnie. That was fun.
Yeah, fun for me too.